The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article is Oprah's intention for the insiders. Oprah shares the importance of creating little moments of joy. Oprah reveals a moving story from her time spent at one of the resiliency hubs in Maui. Hi, everybody. I heard a really moving story today when I was over in Lahaina delivering the generators that finally came. I met a wonderful gentleman named Kaipo, who is running one of the resiliency hubs over there. That's what they're calling these pop-up shelters where people can come and get whatever they need. Diapers, canned goods, and in this case, use the generator. I was so moved by what he had to tell me about the first night, when everybody was just so stunned and had fled from their homes and were still in shock. They were all together with their children, and there was a decision made to buy Twinkies for the children. The children were so delighted to have the Twinkies that it brought a moment of joy, just for a moment, to the parents watching their children be delighted over the Twinkies. And he said, after that, every time somebody would do a small gesture or offer something in kindness that would make someone smile or feel better, that they called them Twinkie moments. I really like that story. Twinkie moments. I told you, Kaipo, I was going to be quoting you about it. So in the meantime, go well. Create your own Twinkie moments for yourself and for anybody else that you can. Have a blessed week. Our next story is over in Culture and News. I was a Vietnamese refugee. She was my white other mother, and I wanted to be just like her until I realized that's exactly what she wanted, too. Owner of a Lonely Heart by Beth Nguyen. We all have other mothers, and Celia, my high school boyfriend's mother, was one of mine. Evan and I almost broke up a dozen times in the years we were together. I'm not sure why he stayed, but I know why I did. I didn't want to lose Celia. This was on the west side of Michigan where I grew up, in an exurb that was becoming a suburb. Celia, who had divorced Evan's dad years ago and married someone else, lived in a yellow house on a property large enough for a horse barn. After school and on weekends, Evan and I spent hours with Celia. We read, talked, and had dinner together. It was the opposite of life at my house, where we all ate whenever we wanted and mostly tried to avoid each other because my dad and stepmom always seemed to be mad at me or one of my siblings or each other. Every day someone was yelling, someone was sulking. My dad would storm off in his truck, disappearing up the driveway. I had no clue then, and maybe none of us did, that we were a family continually being shaped by a past, who we were, how we had gotten here, that would never leave us. Growing up in the Midwest in a refugee family that had left Vietnam at the end of the war, too much of my sense of self was shaped around observations of how other people behaved. I had observed how Evan played on the soccer team, how he was funny in a way that didn't rely on belittling others, and how he could write a thesis statement faster than anyone else. Like almost everyone else in my school, Evan was white, and his family had been in the United States for generations. It was a surprise to everyone, especially me, when we started going out. I have wondered since if maybe I had learned how to assimilate so much, assimilation being the messed-up demand of that era, that maybe Evan hadn't even seen me as Asian. We never talked about race. He didn't bring it up. Why would he? And I didn't either. After I met Celia, my gaze turned to her. I saw that she had cloth napkins at every dinner, that she kept newspapers and magazines in baskets not piled on any available surface. Celia would drop a handful of snapdragons or tulips into a pitcher-shaped vase on an antique table in the hallway. She would appear in a plain turtleneck sweater, effortlessly glamorous, and I would admire the way she'd take up a jacket or sweater as she left the house, just in case. Before Celia, I had never seen, outside of a TV show, a parent having conversations with their kid that had nothing to do with permission or scolding or rules. Celia and Evan talked about whatever was on their minds. They laughed together a lot. When Celia asked questions, it never felt like she was prying, trying to get to a secret side of me, the way it often did when white people asked questions about my family, as if driven by a colonizing curiosity. When Celia asked what kind of orchids my grandmother grew, and how did she take care of them, or what was my first memory, or what were my parents like, whatever I answered, I knew that she wouldn't hang on to it for judgment or ridicule or future ammunition. Later in life, I realized the enormous generosity of this. It was kind of freedom, and I didn't even know it. But mostly, I didn't tell the truth about myself. I never talked about how my family had left Vietnam, or about the way we dealt, or didn't deal, with the aftermath of so much turmoil. No, I was ready to show, instead, that I was more American than anyone else, and known all the state capitals since elementary school, had memorized facts about the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, had taken a literal test to prove myself worthy of citizenship. I was immersed in the systems that I had been taught that would take decades to undo. One Christmas, Celia gave me a canvas tote bag from L.L. Bean, my initials stitched on the pocket in red. Inside, more gifts, including a set of monogrammed stationery, cream-colored cardstock with my initials embossed at the top. I had never had anything monogrammed before. To see my name in that way, the actual words hidden, conveyed instead by initials, B.M.N., felt at once startling and revelatory. It felt exactly like what I was and where I was, both hidden and unhidden, trying to find some in-between. In the months and years to come, I would take out the embossed cards and stare at them, too beautiful to use. It might be the middle of summer, and suddenly I'd be thinking about Christmas, about Celia, planning her gifts so many weeks in advance. I pictured her tying ribbons and settling the packages just so inside the canvas bag. It had given her pleasure to do this, I know, as it would have given me. And she did know me then. She knew the life I was studying. She knew that I would save the stationery and that I would keep the monogrammed bag forever, filling it with books or clothes, bringing it with me to beaches or overnight trips. It was only much later that I recognized that these gifts, too, were emblems of whiteness that I had been trying to learn and that maybe she had tried even to help me learn, that she had seen me observing and striving and wanted to provide. Assimilation is an old, awful, out-of-date idea, but it defined generations, including mine, and it hadn't disappeared. It's just gotten quieter. Assimilation requires a constant form of gaslighting. Sometimes, after Evan dropped me off and I walked up the steps to my parents' cottage-looking house, I could almost feel myself shape-shifting back to the girl my family knew. The nerdy one. The weird one. "Too big for your britches," my stepmom would say. So often I was exhausted. It would be years before I understood that as the exhaustion of pretense, of trying to navigate white spaces and expectations, I didn't even recognize that Celia, too, was part of the system that held whiteness as a goal. I would have told anyone that she was on my side, but maybe that really meant that I would also always understand her more than she would understand me. Evan never came over to my house. None of my friends did. I was embarrassed by the undone rooms that my dad kept starting to renovate but never got close to finishing. I didn't want anyone to see the little room I had shared with my sister, our twin beds divided by a dresser that was so old it left wood shavings on our clothes with every opening and closing of the drawers. Most of all, I didn't want to face any questions about how we lived, about Buddha and his altar, about my grandmother and her meditation. All of that tapped into a different feeling, something like privacy, a sense of protection. Evan and other boys after him described me as withholding. It wasn't untrue. I think I was trying to withhold myself from any gaze that felt like a demand, that felt like ownership. I didn't want to be made to explain this life to anyone who didn't already know it. Evan and I broke up in college but stayed friends for a while, which meant I stayed in touch with Celia, though eventually all of that ended too. In the decades that followed, I missed Celia the most. I would think of her whenever I used that monogram tote bag, or whenever I saw a 1960s picture of Jackie Kennedy, whom I had always thought Celia resembled. To friends, I've sometimes referred to her as the mother-in-law who got away. By that, I mean a structure, a series of possibilities that can emerge from such a codified relationship. And because I never did get a mother-in-law like that, in ways both gentle and blunt, Celia mentored and mothered me. She taught me ways of whiteness I couldn't have learned on my own. The hieroglyphics, as Edith Wharton called them in The Age of Innocence, of a coded society. Once, after Evan and I broke up, I visited Celia in the South Carolina town where she and her husband had moved for a while for his work. Celia and I walked through the old downtown, and I got my first glimpses of Spanish moss draped over old trees and serpentine stone walls that made me think of ghosts. We went into a card store, and an 80s Elton John song was playing. Some things look better just passing through. In this southern town, as in so many places I'd been in my life up to that point, white people stared at me. Rarely did they bother to hide it. They seemed instead to stare hard on purpose. I should have been nervous or uncomfortable, as I usually was, but I wasn't, because I was with Celia, a beautiful, tall, white woman who had grace in her stride and money in her purse. Her company, the clarity of being seen with her, was armor. Did she know this? What was I even doing there, visiting this woman to whom I had no logical claim? What did I think I deserved? It wasn't yet the last time I'd see Celia, but the moment held a strange sense of sorrow, the nostalgia that lasts the duration of an old pop song. I was already thinking ahead to the ending of it. What would play next? How soon I would leave this place and go back to college, back to whatever life I thought I was going to get to have after that. We're heading on over into lifestyle and relationships. This article is entitled 8 Unexpected Sources of Love in Your Life. On days when the world forgot to send support, don't overlook the surprising places and people sending affection your way. Number 1. When your friend gives you a dozen umbrellas, it's a metaphor, but also you can never have enough umbrellas. Years ago, in the middle of a meandering conversation, I complained about umbrellas to a good friend. Only a good friend would tolerate such a diatribe. I told her that I never had enough umbrellas, and the umbrellas I did have were the super cheapo kind that break the instant you unfurl them, and I said that my dream was to one day have a large collection of high-quality umbrellas. Was this a metaphor, my friend wondered, for wanting protection from the maelstrom of life? Maybe, I said, but mostly I just hated it when my wet jeans stuck to my legs and the contents of my purse got all soggy. A few months later, on my birthday, the friend handed me a gift bag containing a dozen totes umbrellas. Most of my dreams in life were more ambitious, she said, but this one was easy enough to realize, and so she'd made it happen. I realized she'd been listening, really listening that day, enough so that she'd remembered this tiny throwaway thing I'd said. My heart swelled so much it threatened to burst out of my chest cavity. But the true beauty of the gift was that every time I opened one of her umbrellas and was spared a soggy purse and wet jean fate, that song of love was reprised in my heart. Number 2. When a toddler hands you something, anything, with their tiny, ever-sticky fingers. Rocks, socks, half-eaten locks, defeated dandelions, threadbare loveys, goldfish crackers. The range of items toddlers will hand you is matched only by the range of reason they will hand you these things. Sometimes they want you to help. Dispose of this, won't you? And sometimes they want to prefer a gift. This rotting crab leg made me think of you. Plenty of times they don't have any idea why they're handing you the item. They just are. No matter who the toddler is, or their motive, or even the thing that's being offered, When a miniature pudgy hand puts something in yours, what they're really handing over is a microdose of love, and possibly Coxsackie virus. 3. When your local barista zhuzhes your beverage just because. One summer in my early 20s, I went to Rome. Every morning, I looked forward to a cappuccino at the local cafe. A few mornings in, the barista handed over my beverage, and I was gobsmacked. There, inscribed into the pillowy milk foam, was a deft swirl of espresso with a heart. For no reason, if I'd been in a film, the opening notes of What a Wonderful World would have undoubtedly started playing. A surge of tender feeling as formidable as Pompeii's volcano erupted in my heart. When I returned home, I told my sister about it, and she pointed out that it was more than a little possible that the barista, being male and Italian, was trying to get into my pants. Some people are born cynics, immune to milky messages of love. So did the barista swirl a heart into the cappuccino of every eligible bachelorette who stopped by? Possibly. Did it lessen its impact on me? Assolutamente no. Number 4. When public restroom goers warn you there's no more toilet paper in a stall. I defy you to think of an act more unexpectedly tender than when a perfect stranger emerging from a public restroom stall warns you that there's no toilet paper left. Because really, it would be so easy for them to say nothing. It's no skin off of their back if you discover the unpleasant surprise after you've dropped trow. What do they care if you're forced to pillage your pockets for any spare scrap of tissue that might be lingering there? All out of TP isn't exactly the three little words one usually connotes with declarations of affection, true, but it's a gesture of caretaking that unfolds in a very private space. And the intimacy of that exchange, I'd argue, puts it staunchly in the category of love. Number 5. When your neighbor's pet likes you best of all. Maybe it's the too cool for school tabby cat that lives across the street and slinks in between your feet when you're unloading your groceries from the car. Maybe it's the parrots outside the corner laundromat who never take the bait of passers-by when they croon, "Hello, bye-bye, hello," but always replies to your greeting. Maybe it's the mutt that drags his owner halfway down the block in his zeal to lick you like a lollipop. There's nothing quite like being the object of affection for someone else's pet. We expect our pets to love us, and we earn this love by feeding them. But when an animal you do absolutely nothing for likes you best of all, you know, beyond the shadow of a doubt, it's because you're special. They can see your spark, and their affections remind you of what a gem you really are. Number 6. When you plant a seed and it actually grows. Some people have green thumbs, and some people have death thumbs that cause plants to shrivel up and die upon contact. You can guess which kind of thumbs I have. Every time I tuck a tiny seed into a mound of dirt, I summon optimism, but really I'm thinking, this is never going to work. How is this going to work? Only Merlin possessed the magical powers required to make a plant actually grow. So I feel positively anointed on the rare occasions when I glance at my flower pot after planting a seed and notice, miracle of miracles, that something is there, something green, something triumphant. Against all odds, a living creature is growing. I have loved the seed by watering it and offering it the most choice indirect sunlight my living room has to offer. And this stunning specimen of botanical wonderment loves me back. Number 7. When you read a part in a book that describes an experience you thought only happened to you. You know this moment. You're skipping along or maybe trudging along in the book you're reading, and suddenly a jolt of recognition flashes through you. You sit up straighter. You read the line again. Could it be? Is it possible? The author is describing a feeling or a thought or an experience that, up until now, you thought had only ever occurred to you. Maybe it's something tiny, like a character confessing they always mispronounced the word misled as misled. Or maybe it's something seismic, like a narrator describing his feelings of helplessness at discovering that he was losing his vision. Each of those two moments stopped me in my tracks and have stayed with me for years and years, because in a profound way they let me know I was not alone. When you see a hidden part of yourself reflected in a book, what you feel is complicated. Part kinship, part understanding, part self-compassion, part love. Number 8. When a romantic partner gives you the nickname you didn't even know you always wanted. The alchemy by which a nickname is produced is a mystery indeed. Who knows what makes someone call their boyfriend Turtle, or their sister Mrs. Kokomo, or their child Teeny Tiny Peddler Woman. I have always desperately wanted a nickname, and not trusting people to come up with adequate options on their own, I've supplied some and tried to make them stick. Nikki was my middle school attempt. Coco was the nickname I promoted post-college. They never caught on, not even a little. And then I fell in love with David, who I called Ephraim, and he fell in love with me. And one of the ways I knew it was for real was that he gave me a nickname. It was not Coco. It was not Nikki. It was not Teeny Tiny Peddler Woman. It was the most literal of nicknames. Nick. If you'd asked me before he coined it, I'd have said it was a little, well, on the nose. But it wasn't. It was perfect. 3 kids, and many years later, hearing the name issue from his lips makes me feel utterly and completely loved. Okay, this article is in Lifestyle. Why a daily dose of awe might just be the new Prozac. A leading researcher explains the mind-blowing science behind that goosebumpy feeling. On a family trip to San Francisco last spring, I was delighted to find that a survey of paintings by Alice Neal, the late great portraitist of ordinary people, was showing at the de Young Museum in Golden Gate Park. I left my husband and sons in the park and ducked into the museum to treat myself to an hour of solo art imbibing. I expected to be engaged by Neil's beautiful loose lines and off-kilter compositions. I did not anticipate, though, the full-on electric soul charge I experienced in those gallery rooms. Neil is a master at capturing the forlorn yet miraculously still hopeful expressions of hard-pressed people doing their best. Gazing into the luminous eyes of Neil's sitters, I felt the vibrating intimacy between the painter and her subjects buzzing along my spine, and I decided then and there to quit the nonprofit job I'd landed in after losing a longtime magazine gig during a cutback and find a way back to my own method of art and portraiture writing. After lots of hustling and networking to find new clients, I'm back to writing full-time and thrilled to be here. But I do wonder occasionally if my pinning my career leap on a spine-tingling epiphany was perhaps a bit rash. So I was glad to connect with Dacher Keltner, that's D-A-C-H-E-R, a psychologist at the University of California, Berkeley. Keltner is a renowned expert in emotions and how they guide human behavior, and in his newest book, Awe, The New Science of Everyday Wonder and How It Can Transform Your Life, is through Penguin Press. He describes how experiencing awe, the feeling of being in the presence of something vast that transcends your current understanding of the world, as he defines it, improves our health and well-being. Awe can be sparked by, among many other things, gazing out over a panoramic view, grooving on the collective effervescence of a packaged dance floor, or witnessing someone doing something kind of for a stranger, a.k.a. committing an act of moral beauty, as Keltner writes. His and others' research shows that awe triggers the release of dopamine, the feel-good neurochemical that helps open the mind to wonder and exploration, and reduces inflammation produced by the immune system, potentially lowering the risk of diseases associated with chronic inflammation, including depression, anxiety, and heart disease. But it also increases empathy, and by quieting brain regions that are activated when we process information from a me-first perspective, the so-called default mode network reduces self-preoccupation and limbers up our thinking. When I tell Keltner on a Zoom call about the aha moment that led me to quit a stable job and try living again by my wits, he responds with an awesomely reassuring fist pump. There's a destabilizing part of awe, which is like, whoa, I'm hearing this loud voice saying you're an artist. He says, doing a weirdly good imitation of me tripping on Alice Neal's paintings. And then there is an empowering part of awe, this engine of creation that drives people to do good work, to keep exploring and opening up new mysteries. Here is more from our chat. I had an experience of mind-blowing awe that cracked me wide open. But you write about how smaller moments of awe can transform day-to-day life. What is everyday awe and how does it crop up? When we talk about emotions, we come up with stereotypes. With awe, it's like, oh, I was looking at the Grand Canyon, or I shook Golden State Warriors coach Steve Kerr's hand. But when we did research and started to tally up the data, we did daily diary studies asking people in different countries to answer the question every night, did you feel awe today? We discovered they experienced it 2 to 3 times a week. I expected that maybe half the people would feel one experience of awe every 2 weeks. And here, they're getting it every 3 days. We heard things from students like they felt it in class, learning about a chemical process, or walking through Berkeley and seeing someone give their lunch to an unhoused person, or that they just looked into the eyes of another person and started to think about human connection. This tells us that if you just take a moment, awe is there for us to experience. It's not reserved for merging with God. It's everywhere. Can people who find themselves at a low ebb creatively or who feel stuck in a job apply awe to find a new path forward? Totally. I get a lot of what should I do questions, and I say, well, what brings you awe? Try to pay your bills and do awe. To me, making a career choice is really a goosebumps question. Try to simulate different possibilities and imagine them. Does fixing someone's physical ailment move you? Or is it looking at data? Or is it getting into another country and helping with disaster response? Building things with your hands? You can project forward to think about what gives you goosebumps, or you can think back to things you've done in the past where you thought, whoa, that was amazing, and see if you can do that thing. You write that people can find awe walking on a crowded street, doing the wave at a sporting event, or just seeing someone thank someone else graciously, and that all these experiences help glue us together as a society because they remind us how interconnected we are. They enable us to see the systems underlying the wonders of life and locate ourselves in relation to them. How so? The Danish professor Søren Kierkegaard wrote about going out into the streets and having these chance encounters with the significance of insignificant things. When I read that, I realize that when we go out and see people doing things collectively, it holds us together. Same with listening to music. We go to hear music, then talk about it with our friends, and then we move through the rest of the day thinking, okay, I've got a team, I'm part of a tribe. I believe it's fundamental to the social fabric. You also share moving stories about your own far-ranging search to rediscover awe after your beloved young brother Rolf died of cancer in 2019. How did traveling to certain places like the mountain trails you and Rolf used to hike in places like India help you through this rough time? It was transformative. After the loss of my brother, I was like, I gotta do awe. I knew I'd find it in the mountains. Going on a wild spiritual retreat in India was also a no-brainer. Listening to Iggy Pop and African music was easy. Listening to classical music was harder. But going to hear a symphony perform a hard John Adams piece was illustrative. Going in, I thought, I don't know classical music, I'm dressed wrong. But I wandered into it, and I wondered about it. Wandering and wondering, I embraced the mystery, and it brought me awe. Now I feel more everyday awe very powerfully. I almost feel like I can get it in an instant, and it really changed my belief about life. Like that it is not just a biological process that ends. It's much more complicated, which I write about. It changed my sense of self, making me really want to go after the things that matter and toward what I can do that is good for the world. It made me healthier. It was transformative. It really was a defining period, and I still feel it. I feel strengthened. It sounds like experiencing awe again helped you separate the wheat from the chaff in your life. Very much so. In midlife, it's a classic problem. Are you doing the things that mean something to you? It brought that into focus for me, but I also want to remind your readers that awe is really good for you. It lowers inflammation and gives you better health, more time. People who experience awe feel like they have more time, and they are less stressed out about the micro hassles of life. They feel less trauma if they really go after it. So it's good news. Awe is good for you. It's about finding life. how can anyone experience a bit of this magic? Do actionable things like take an awe walk, where you try to see your surroundings with fresh eyes, or tell awe stories like the one you shared with me. Listen to music that brought you goosebumps when you were a teenager, and pay attention where your mind goes. We are overplanned, overscheduled, and Google Maps tells us exactly where to go. But we need to wander and wonder. We need to go to mystery. Still in lifestyle, this one is, I lost 45 pounds on Ozempic, but it's no silver bullet. The Wonder weight loss drug was just the beginning of one woman's long journey to heal her traumatic relationship with food. I've been on Ozempic for about a year and a half for my type 2 diabetes. My blood sugar levels are normal, and yes, I've lost weight. I started taking the drug before its Wonder weight loss properties hit the news, before Jimmy Kimmel made an Ozempic joke minutes into hosting the Oscars, before thin women who wanted to be thinner began shooting their bellies with that familiar blue pen I use every Wednesday morning. This was also before my neighborhood pharmacy and local Safeway encountered supply issues. Now I call the CVS every month, hoping I won't have to hunt down my prescription elsewhere. Let's get the stats out of the way first. I've lost 45 pounds since I started taking Ozempic. I'm 5'11", and I've always joked that it takes a 35-pound weight loss for people to start noticing. Sadly, I can say this with authority because since my early 30s, I've lost and gained a total of 660 pounds. You read that number correctly. The abridged narrative goes like this. Most of my life I was a lean, athletic person, even if I thought I wasn't. I gained a total of 110 pounds with my two pregnancies and joined Weight Watchers to drop 55 pounds after each, and then gained and lost another 40 twice after that. Myriad low-carb diets helped me knock off more 40-pound chunks until I'd eat a bagel, and then another, and another. Perhaps this is why I'm not doing any cartwheels over the latest drop, my late mother's term for a big weight loss, as opposed to the last hurrah, the treat she would eat before starting a new diet. My last hurrahs can last years. I used to love it when people commented on a new me. Now I hate it. How did you do it? They ask. I don't want to fuel the Ozempic craze. I don't want to dangle a magic bullet in front of anyone who does not need the medication, who buys into the Hollywoodness of yet another diet trick, who is struggling to understand that wellness, wholeness, is an inside job. This new chapter of my story is real and hopeful, so I'm sharing it instead. I've experienced disordered eating and blood sugar fluctuations my entire life, but diabetes cropped up during my first pregnancy. I injected insulin into my thigh while carrying both of my kids. The diabetes went away after each delivery, but the fear of its return loomed. This was 22 years ago. At every annual checkup since, I've striven to score A pluses on my hemoglobin A1C, fasting blood sugar, and weight. In 2018, I failed every test and was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. And in 2021, my numbers spiked and my former doctors prescribed Ozempic on top of pills I'd already been taking. Now at a normal weight, I'm able to wear every bra in my undergarment drawer. My internist attributed my loss primarily to Ozempic, and she's partly right. The nausea sure did help shrink my appetite in the beginning, but it takes more than a weekly shot to keep me well. These are the tools I use every single day, maybe every single minute, to manage my health and heal my relationship with my body. Facing my shame. Hat tip to Brené Brown on this one. The shame I felt when I stepped on my doctor's scale after a weight gain hobbled me. Didn't I want to stave off diabetes? Be the healthiest version of myself? Of course I did. Even some of my close friends didn't know that I have type 2 diabetes. The shame runs like a deep river through my family. Some of my most beloved relatives have fat-shamed anyone who has designs to put on some weight, including themselves. My maternal grandmother starved herself after she remarried. No, Grandpa and I will split that raisin, was the family joke. In the short run, sugar dulls my shame because it soothes me like alcohol and weed never have. A donut, or four, helps numb the stray emotions, happy or sad, that I absorb. Here, hand them over. My pattern has been fixed myself a good stiff carton of ice cream to settle myself down. Self-soothing. Restriction and addiction are rooted into my family. My mom once told me that my raisin-splitting grandmother would take her for a hot fudge sundae when my grandfather was using. He could be so cruel, she said. Undoing family patterns. There is nothing more liberating than the belief that we can transcend our most painful family patterns. 10 years ago, I was compelled to write a novel about the multi-generational ripples of addiction, which led me to a support group to further understand the emotional history of my characters. 5 seconds in, I realized I needed to be there. I learned that shame is embedded in any family with a history of substance abuse, and that letting go of mine helps spare me from the hamster wheel of diet culture. I'm still learning which emotions are mine and which I'm mopping up for someone else who never asked me to in the first place. Learning to stay in my lane, detach with love, and grasp the broader emotional context for my impulses brings me the peace I will never find at the bottom of a pint of Ben and Jerry's. I still have to go to a meeting every single week, though, because managing myself demands ruthless vigilance. Healing is not a straight line, and when I misstep, I promptly forgive myself. Self-shame is too costly. Rethinking restriction. Shame and restriction are kissing cousins. I feel shame about my body, and the more shame I feel, the more I eat. Then I restrict to lose weight for a physical or a social event. Restricting always leads to overeating, which leads to fear for my health and more self-loathing. Rinse and repeat and repeat and repeat. Now all foods are on the table unless I make a choice to remove them. Although I do track my carbs in order to manage my blood sugar, I bake and treat myself to those little Valentine's Day candy hearts. If I pass on chocolate mousse too many times, I will track down a Hostess facsimile, usually at a 7-Eleven. For me, wolfing down a Suzy Q in my car is akin to downing a bottle of wine alone in your living room after a hard day. Rewiring my brain. Here's where it gets good. Along my journey, I encountered a therapist who hooked me up to a neurofeedback machine during our sessions. The training literally interrupted brain patterns linked to my destructive habits. Later, I met a nutritionist who understood the spiritual and psychological dance of my relationship with food. She taught me meditation techniques like tapping to disrupt the fierce urge to hit the pantry. Together, these guides planted seeds I've watered. They taught me that I actually have agency. Well, I do if I remember. And I pray. I ask for grace for the moment to ask myself if I want to swap my serenity for a piece of cake. Simply pausing to ask that question gives me the peace to act in my best interest. And I write. I've learned that I can write a new story for myself. A big trigger for me is telling the worn story about my success with a diet du jour. My current victory laps derive from second-by-second choices that allow me to repave old neural pathways. There is no such thing as a weight loss panacea. I'm grateful to my doctor for her care and for prescribing an effective drug for my diabetes. Before I left her practice for insurance reasons, I wrote her a letter that ended like this. My goals for my body and mind cannot be measured by a scale or a blood test. Let the byproducts of my equanimity materialize as they may. Welcome to my renewal. I am exfoliating years of old skin, hopefully to emerge as my own light. In culture and news, I have the article, Today host Hoda Kotb gave a rare life update about Kathy Lee Gifford. The news anchor spoke about her former co-star on the air while marking a life milestone. Hoda Kotb may be hosting today's fourth hour with Jenna Bush Hager, but she hasn't forgotten about her relationship with former co-host Kathy Lee Gifford. During an August 17th taping of the NBC Morning Show, Hoda, Chenille Jones, Craig Melvin, and Al Roker celebrated their former colleague as Gifford marked her 70th birthday. As the quartet saw family photos and discussed the impact Gifford made while working alongside them, Kotb chose to disclose how she was doing 4 years after she exited Today, after 11 years in 2019. When Kathy chose to leave here and go to Nashville, she's been doing nothing but creating and making new memories, she explained. I think she's happier than she's ever been. What's more, Coatby didn't stop congratulating her comrade on the air. Just a day earlier, she went on Instagram to deliver a short and sweet message about the milestone Gifford reached in her life. Happy birthday to you, to the one who brings the fun, she wrote on August 16th. I love you, @KathyL. Gifford. When fans saw the Making Space podcast host publicly acknowledge her one-time co-star's special occasion online, they immediately rushed to send well wishes in the comments. Happy birthday, Kathy Lee. Love seeing this picture of you two together. Have a beautiful day, one person wrote on Instagram. Happy birthday, KLG. Love you ladies together, another chimed in. Happy birthday, Kathy. I miss you two together, a different follower reminisced. As viewers of today may remember, Gifford stepped away from the show so she could experience life out of the spotlight. After making Nashville her permanent home, she later spoke out about the reason behind the big move. I have a whole community of people here that share my faith, she told People in August 2022. It's been good for my soul, let me tell you. They also let me be just a person down here, too, Gifford said. It's so wonderful to be a private person for a change. We're still in culture and news. Britney Spears breaks silence on Sam Asghari divorce. I'm a little shocked. On Friday night, Britney Spears broke her silence on divorce from Sam Asghari. The pop star posted a video of herself dancing to Janet Jackson's song, If I Was Your Girl, in neon green bikini bottoms, an off-the-shoulder cropped peasant top, and a pair of black cowboy boots. While Spears seemed to be enjoying her dance routine, her caption revealed that the end of her relationship was a surprise after 6 years together. As everyone knows, Hesam and I are no longer together. 6 years is a long time to be with someone, so I'm a little shocked, but I'm not here to explain why, because it's honestly nobody's business, she began. Spears continued, but I couldn't take the pain anymore, honestly. In some sort of telepathic way, I have been receiving so many messages that melt my heart from friends, and I thank you. I've been playing it strong for way too long, and my Instagram may seem perfect, but it's far from reality, and I think we all know that. I would love to show my emotions and tears on how I really feel, but some reason I've always had to hide my weaknesses. If I wasn't my dad's strong soldier, I would be sent away to places to get fixed by doctors. But that's when I needed family the most. You're supposed to be loved unconditionally, not under conditions. So I will be as strong as I can and do my best, and I'm actually doing pretty good. Anyways, have a good day and don't forget to smile. When news of the divorce broke, rumors began to circulate that Asghari was unhappy with the prenup between them and hoping to break it. He allegedly threatened to share private information about Spears if she would not concede. According to Page Six, they have been living separately for months. Britney wanted a fairy tale and she didn't get it. She felt that Sam's love was not unconditional, an insider told the publication. Of course she feels let down. Anyone would when your partner's not providing for you in the way you feel you need to be provided for. She booked great high-end vacations and paid for everything. They went everywhere on private jet. They continued, but he was not super present. You only have to ask where was he when Britney was filming all her Instagram videos? He would just disappear for months to go filming and she would be left all alone. There were times when he would just get up and go. It was also alleged that Spears cheated on Asghari and that she had physically attacked him. The source denied it, saying there was no cheating, and he's 6'2" and she's 5'2", so how could she attack him? The honest truth of it is that it's complicated. This wasn't a whiplash decision. It's been in the works for the past months. Another friend said Britney is strong. She's feeling like, whoa, like you would in any breakup when you've been with someone for 6 years. But she's very clear-headed, and she's not holed up all alone crying. Another stated, I think Britney gets a bad rap. She's a true artist in the way that she processes things, in the way that she creates, but she's doing incredibly well under the circumstances. Asghari's rep, Brandon Cohen, denied suggestions that they would be challenging the prenup, saying in a statement, there are many claims that Sam is challenging the prenup and threatening to exploit his ex-wife with videos. However, all these claims are false, as no negative intention has ever been directed towards her and never will be. Sam has always and will always support her. A source responded by saying, of course, this is what everyone was worried about. There was always a concern that Brittany would end up isolated and on her own, and that's what has happened. None of this surprises me, and unfortunately, I do believe that where this is all headed is very sad. Parts of this article were edited due to time. Still in culture and news, Kelly Ripa was asked if she plans to ever leave Live, and she didn't hold back. The Let's Talk Off Camera podcast star opened up about where she sees her future on daytime television. For more than two decades, there has been no Live without Kelly Ripa as co-host. But will there ever be a time when she's not the face of the show? According to her, it's definitely possible. In an interview published with The Purist, the TV personality opened up about what life is like co-hosting Live with her husband, Mark Consuelos. When asked about her future on the show, Kelly got candid about the fact that she has thought about stepping away from daytime television after 22 years on the air. But as she explained to the outlet, while she has been presented with different opportunities over the years, she feels good about where she currently stands. I think the risk-averse quality I have is probably the reason I stayed with the same job for so long, she said. Others' offers come along, but I like to stick with what I know. I am very steadfast in everything I do, and so when you have me for life. Despite the LiveWire author sharing how she intends to stay on as a live co-host for the foreseeable future, she did hint that she thinks a lot about what life would be like away from TV. Although she didn't give an exact timeline of when she may retire, she did express that she's happy in her current position with her husband at her side. Having said that, I don't intend to work at this job for the rest of my life, she added. I do talk about retirement with great interest, but right now I'm very happy, especially working with Mark. Fans may remember that Kelly has had a number of co-hosts throughout her time on Live, including Regis Philbin and Michael Strahan. In April, her co-host Ryan Seacrest stepped away from Live after 6 years in order to continue hosting American Idol and take on Wheel of Fortune in September 2024. Should the All My Children alum ever decide to leave Live, she does have lots of other projects in the works to keep her busy. In addition to her career as an author, she also hosts the Let's Talk Off Camera podcast, which drops new episodes every Wednesday. Still in culture and news, Kelly Clarkson changed the lyrics to Piece by Piece, and it's not a great look for Brandon Blackstock. They will never have to wonder their worth because, unlike you, I'm going to put them first. Kelly Clarkson wrote Piece by Piece about her relationship with Brandon Blackstock before they hit a rough patch, and she just performed the song for the first time since their split, and some lyrical changes have most certainly been made. Speaking to her audience in Las Vegas, Clarkson said, "This song I initially wrote just super hopeful, right? And well, sometimes hopeful turns into hopeless. So here we go, piece by piece." So, what changes were made to the song? This is the old chorus. "But piece by piece he collected me up off the ground, where you abandoned things. Yeah, piece by piece he filled the holes that you burned in me at 6 years old. And you know, he never walks away. He never asks for money. He takes care of me. He loves me. Piece by piece he restored my faith that a man can be kind and a father could stay." The new lyrics? "Piece by piece I collected me off the ground where you abandoned things. Piece by piece I filled the holes that you burned in me at 6 years old. I just walk away when they ask for money. I take care of me because I love me. Piece by piece I restored my faith that a heart can still beat even when it breaks." She also made tweaks to the final chorus of the song, which originally went, "Piece by piece I fell far from the tree. I will never leave him like you left me. And she will never have to wonder her worth because unlike you, I'm going to put her first. And you know, he'll never walk away. He'll never break her heart. He'll take care of things. He'll love her piece by piece. He restored my faith that a man can be kind and a father should be great." The new version goes, "Piece by piece I fell far from the tree. I will never leave them like you left me. And they will never have to wonder their worth because unlike you, I'm going to put them first. I never walk away. I never break their hearts. I'll take care of things when you leave scars. Piece by piece, I restored my faith that a heart can still beat, even if it breaks. So over in Culture and News, we have four ways to help residents of Maui amid the devastating wildfires. As fires spread across the island, relief organizations need more support. Here's how to help. For the past several days, wildfires have blazed through Maui, resulting in widespread evacuations and leaving thousands of residents without homes. There have been 55 confirmed deaths since the start of the wildfires. On Thursday, Oprah, who has lived part-time on the island for the past 15 years, helped hand out supplies at the War Memorial Stadium in Wailuku, which has been converted to a shelter and resource center. As rescue and emergency operations continue, there are a number of organizations you can support to help those in need on the island of Maui. Hawaii Red Cross. The Hawaii Red Cross has shelters set up across Maui and Hawaii's island for evacuees displaced by the fires. You can donate to support these shelters through its website or text the word Red Cross to TO 90999 to make a $10 donation. Hawaii Community Foundation's Maui Strong Fund. The Hawaii Community Foundation is a resource partner, funder, and advocate for the people of Hawaii. It's Maui Strong Fund, which provides community resilience with resources for disaster preparedness, response, and recovery, is currently directing all donations toward the communities affected by the wildfires, and that's spelled H-A-W-A-I-I Community Foundation. Hawaii Salvation Army. The Hawaii Salvation Army has been organizing mass feedings that are expected to expand to all shelters across Maui. It is asking for donations to help it respond quickly with critical services like emergency shelter, food, and emotional and spiritual care. A list of current volunteer options can be also be found at hawaii.salvationarmy.org. Maui Humane Society. The Maui Humane Society is seeking emergency foster families to help house pets who have been lost, burned, or affected by the smoke. You can donate funds through its site, but it also has an Amazon wish list of supplies that will help those taking in the animals. To learn more about it, its SOS fostering program, I'm going to click here. What is an SOS foster? When the space in our shelter becomes limited due to the highly population of animals, we urgently need the community to open their hearts and homes for 2 weeks to open up space for new animals. Another article in Culture and News. Duchess Meghan is glowing in rare photo with her girlfriends. The royal is living the low-key California life. Duchess Meghan is living the low-key California life with her friends. The royal made a rare cameo in a group selfie shared by her friend, entrepreneur Micah Harris, who runs purpose-driven self-care California business Highbrow Hippie. Belated B-Day celebrations with these lovely muses. Missing sweet at S-E-R-G-E-N-O-R-M-A-N-T, Harris wrote over the photo of poet Cleo Wade Markle and hair colorist Katie Lee on a lunch date. In the snap, Markle looks lovely in a simple black tank top and dainty gold pendant necklace by Ariel Gordon. Her skin is glowing and she seems to wear minimal natural makeup. The Duchess affectionately hugs Wade and Lee while smiling widely at the camera. Markle has been lying low this year. The royal did not join husband Prince Harry at King Charles III's coronation in May and instead stayed back in Montecito, California with their two kids, Prince Archie and Princess Lilibet. Since then, she has been spotted out several times in her neighborhood. This past weekend, she effortlessly embraced quiet luxury in a camel-colored wrap coat by Max Mara, M-A-R-A, which she wore open over a beige sweater, white jeans, tan and black Chanel slingbacks, and a white Goyard, G-O-Y-A-R-D, tote bag. She topped off the look with a blue, white, and yellow cashmere Hermes shawl, a black and gold Givenchy belt, white pearl earrings, and an array of silver rings. And last month, the Duchess was photographed shopping at a local farmer's market while wearing a slinky sand-colored jumpsuit paired with a white linen button-down, a large raffia tote bag, and a black Avatar sunglasses with golden frames. Over in Oprah's Insiders, Oprah says that each birthday is a new beginning. With each birthday, you get to decide whether to mark it as the end of your greatest days or the beginning of your finest hours. Hi, everybody. I wanted to ask you all a question. How do you feel about your birthday? I know some of you love the special day and relish in getting that happy birthday song, eating your favorite dessert, or are just excited about turning another age. Other people avoid the day like the plague, not willing to recognize getting a year older. However you feel about your birthday, consider this. Take age out of the equation. Think about how you feel inside your body and reflect on how far you've come over the past 365 days. Today, as many of you know, and this is a past insider's, is my 69th birthday. For me, it is such a reward to be turning 69 and to be strong and healthy. This time last year, I was getting over a double knee operation, and now I have never felt better. As I turn 69, I choose not to focus on the number. For me, the number has always just been a marker. Instead, I choose to celebrate the time I've spent living, taking note of all the shifts, the wins, the accomplishments, how much I've grown over the past year, and I look forward to all that is to come. Next year, I'm going to be turning 70. Where do I want to be by the time I hit 70? What do I want to accomplish this year? How do I want to feel? May I suggest you think about these things, too. And as I've said, with each birthday, you get to decide whether to mark it as the end of your greatest days or the beginning of your finest hours. I choose the latter and hope that you do, too, because each trip around the sun gifts us with a new beginning. What lies ahead in the future, none of us knows, but I'm encouraging you to expect some delight. There will be challenges, of course, but lots of delight. I hope you all have a wonderful week. I'm going to have a wonderful birthday. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. And so long until next time.